This is Judaism Unbound, episode 61, Wandering in the Wilderness. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofus.
And we're here today launching a 7 or 8, we haven't quite figured it out yet, how many episode series, where we are going to be looking sort of as a metaphor for everything that we've been exploring up till now, the story of what happened after the Exodus. And since this episode is going up just at the beginning of Passover, we thought it would be really interesting to attach this idea to the idea of the Omer, which is one of those Jewish times of year that a lot of people don't really know about, don't really observe. It has historical origins in Biblical Judaism and Second Temple Judaism as a time that was related to agricultural activities of various kinds. But one of the ways that we want to consider re-understanding the Omer today is to look at it more in relationship to the holidays that bookend it. On the one hand, Passover, and on the other hand, Shavuot. So in Rabbinic Judaism, the holiday of Passover essentially is a reenactment of the Exodus, and the holiday of Shavuot is essentially a reenactment of the giving of the Torah at Sinai, which we're interpreting as that moment where we figure out what the new Judaism is. And so essentially that 7 weeks between those two holidays conceivably could be a time in which we reenact that period of not knowing, that period of wandering aimlessly in the wilderness after we've been liberated, but before we've actually figured out what's next. And so in a sense, that's really what this podcast has always been about. And we thought it would be an interesting idea to float this possibility that maybe as a new Jewish practice, we could sort of reenact that period of not knowing on an annual basis, and that that might actually be helpful to us in this attempt to rethink Judaism for the next period going forward. So we're really excited to be here together with our friends from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, because we thought that actually in our time today, a landscape that is sort of analogous to the wilderness as a place in which new things are experimented with all the time and new discoveries are made and people are trying to put the pieces together into trying to envision what that next future is going to look like, that it would actually be interesting to explore the landscape of Silicon Valley as an analogous landscape to the wilderness. So we've put together a series of interviews with folks in prominent positions in Silicon Valley over the next few weeks. And we're really excited about the idea that by talking to people who are actively engaged in this process in Silicon Valley, we might be able to derive some new ideas about Judaism. So before we jump into our conversation, Lex, anything you want to add to that framing?
Yes, I am dying to. So I wanted to just mention that this counting of the Omer, it's a funny word. So it's spelled with an ayin in Hebrew, and it's Omer. And it refers to this measure of barley, this agricultural counting that happens. But what's funny is that if you say Omer typically and it's spelled with an aleph, it means to talk, basically. So I think it's very appropriate that we're gathering a whole slew of conversations over the next 7 weeks, because if you think of Omer in that alternative spelling kind of mechanism, it's all about, you know, talking.
So I'm really excited to welcome as our co-host for this episode of Judaism Unbound and our co-participants in this discussion of trying to look at the Omer this way, Zach Bodner, who is the chief executive officer of the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, and Tova Birnbaum, who is the director of Jewish content at the JCC. And we really think of the JCC in Palo Alto as kind of that Jewish outpost in this land of reimagining. So that's why we really think it's especially interesting to talk with the Jewish leaders in that area as we start to think about what we're going to have as conversations with the technology leaders that we're going to talk to in the next few weeks. So Zach and Tova, welcome to Judaism Unbound.
Thank you. It's our great pleasure. We are longtime listeners and first-time co-hosts, so this is a thrill for us.
Yes, it's very exciting. Thank you so much for having us, Daniel and Lex.
So before we jump into the conversation, I was just wondering if you might say a little bit about your perspective on how you're framing your work in the Jewish community in Palo Alto in light of the ideas that we've been floating, whether today or over the year that you've been listening to the podcast.
Our vision here at the Ashman Family JCC is to be the architects of the Jewish future. We think that there is so much to be learned and gained from this incredible heritage that we have. And we think that there are a lot of folks that are stepping away from Judaism. You know, when you think about Rabbi Lappe's idea of the crash, you know, this is almost home base for people who are kind of stepping away, voting with their feet, walking away from Judaism. And we think there's an opportunity to reinvent Judaism, to make it meaningful, relevant, and joyous in people's lives today. And just like this is the center of tech innovation, I mean, Silicon Valley is a fountainhead. What starts here ends up spreading all over the world. That doesn't have to just be for ag tech and biotech and med tech and high tech. That can also be for Judaism.
So I must say that I feel very lucky. You know, I started my journey in a very traditional, I would say orthodox, almost ultra-orthodox family in a town called Bnei Brak. I'm sure some people know this place. It's geographically very close to Tel Aviv, but in other senses, it's a bit far from Tel Aviv. And actually coming here after a long journey of, being a very good and shy student in all girls schools, and then suddenly slowly opening my eyes to other possibilities. Actually, I really like telling the story of me starting the Jewish journey. You know, although I was very, very observant, and yes, I learned a lot as a religious girl, I actually started my Jewish journey in America, and it happens to so many Israelis. I came here at the age of 19. I was teaching in an Orthodox high school, but it was very, very different. The orthodoxy that I encountered here is different. And that really was, I would say, a slippery slope to actually exploring and finding out that there are so many ways to be Jewish. I was very lucky to be one of the founders of the secular yeshiva of Bina in Tel Aviv, understanding that even though you're not observant, you have the right and even the obligation to feel at home within the Jewish heritage and the Jewish text. And having my background being, you know, as a basis for me to not only teach it as it is, but actually to develop it and reshape it.
You know, Tova, you mentioned the secular yeshiva, and I think to a lot of our listeners, that's going to sound like an oxymoron. We've had a little bit of introduction to it through Bnei Lappe, who has talked about her traditionally radical yeshiva. I think the ideas are similar, but could you tell us a little bit about what it means to have a secular yeshiva?
Secular yeshiva for the American ear is almost impossible. So in Hebrew, we use the word chiloni. And chiloni actually means, you know, in Israel, if you are Jewish, then you are Jewish and you live Jewish life, although you're not even aware of that because everything, the public sphere is in Hebrew and the Jewish calendar is celebrated and so on. But, you know, the political situation in Israel has been that one community, the Orthodox community, actually decides for the whole community, for everyone, what Judaism is. So, you know, the fact that there is no separation between religion and state actually creates Jewish laws, and only one part of the community actually is participating in the conversation about what a Jewish state should look like. What does it mean to have a Jewish state? So the secular yeshiva of Bina was actually founded 20 years ago, right after the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, Prime Minister Rabin. That time, it was actually a time of crisis in Israeli society. Having a religious person, someone who wears a kippah, who went to a religious university, Bar Ilan, actually opened a Jewish book or consulted with a rabbi. And his thought was, yeah, that's the Jewish thing to do, to actually take someone's life. And that created such a big crisis in Israeli society. A lot of people who are not observant, who call themselves chiloni, said, you know what, if that is Judaism, I don't want anything to do with it. So the people of Bina, secular people, most of them actually are people from kibbutzim, from kibbutzes, said, we need to be part of the conversation. First, we need to study. We need to feel at home within the Jewish world. We need to be friendly with the Jewish bookshelf. And we need to reclaim the ownership on our heritage, whatever I do in my home, whatever my relationship with God is, still I can be very, very much enriched with Jewish culture. And politically, it means that everybody needs to be around the table when we want to shape the Jewishness, the character of the Jewish state. And that means, what is a wedding? What does a marriage mean in Israel? A divorce? What does it mean to have Shabbat? Is Shabbat in the Jewish state needs to be a halachic Shabbat, and so on? So more and more people, most of them are actually not observant, open the books, learn Torah, learn Talmud, learn halacha, learn history, also combine it with modern texts and find new relevance and new meaning. And they want to be part of the conversation about shaping the character of the Jewish state and talking together about what does it mean to have a marriage in the Jewish state, divorce in the Jewish state, Shabbat. Is Shabbat in the public sphere of the Jewish state? Does it need to be a halachic Shabbat? Or maybe we should go back to the social elements of Shabbat in the Bible, and so on.
So in a way, what I'm hoping that we might do today on this episode is kind of our session will be similar to what goes on in a secular yeshiva, which on the one hand, we're looking at a Jewish text, at a Jewish story, specifically the story of the Exodus. And we're looking at it, though, in a way that doesn't necessarily presume any theological preconditions, that I think that we can helpfully look at this story as a metaphor that's actually valuable to us, and regardless of what we think about its provenance. And I would throw out there that I have a feeling that, or at least I like to think about the text of the Torah having been put into place by Jews who were living in the Babylonian exile, who had just had the first temple destroyed, right? And who said, we are essentially out here, right? We've had our whole idea of what it means to be Jewish or an Israelite fixed in a certain way that had to do with a monarchy and had to do with sacrifices at a temple. And now here we are in exile in Babylonia, and we don't know what to do. And that it would be at a time like that, that the cultural mythic heritage that they had of these stories of the Exodus from Egypt and the wandering in the wilderness might have felt especially resonant. I've always wondered whether maybe some brilliant authors, some brilliant creators at that time put together a set of stories that they had in a way that's actually quite similar to the way that Shakespeare used old material, but put it together in a beautiful way and as a coherent story, and that they really wanted to tell this story about that time when we didn't know who we were and what happened, what were some of the key elements that helped us get from that period of liberation or that period of leaving what we knew before we got to that time when we were settled again, whether that means Sinai, where we got the Torah, or when we got to the land of Canaan and we sort of settled in. So I don't want to be necessarily religiously fixed only on the stories that happen in the Torah in that very short period between the liberation from Egypt and the giving of the Torah at Sinai. I think we can look at some of the stories of the wilderness more broadly and kind of mine them for what we might potentially use as key texts in the construction or in the reconstruction of a new Jewish observance of the Omer, in which we really take that as our annual reenactment of the time of not knowing, the time of wandering. So for me, at least, one of the stories that I think, has always registered a lot for me is the story of Moses' father-in-law, Jethro, who comes to visit Moses very early on in the story, very early after the Exodus. It appears that Moses had actually sent his wife and children to go stay with her father while he was doing all the miracles and whatnot and getting the Israelites out of Egypt. And then as soon as he's on the road, his father-in-law comes back with his family. And, you know, one interpretation is to say, and he's like, you know, take your family back, you know, do your job as a father too, as a husband. Or, you know, it's more just like, well, now you've done it, so now I can bring your family back. But he doesn't just bring the family back. He gives Moses some advice. And he says, Look, Moses, you don't know what you're doing. You have no leadership experience, but I, Jethro, he's an experienced leader of the Midianites, and he gives Moses a series of pieces of advice, one of which is to kind of divide the people up into these groups of tens, fifties, hundreds, and thousands. But the other piece, at least as I've always read it, is that the first thing that Jethro does when he arrives is he throws a big party. And, you know, he basically says that, you know, Moses, you're kind of a downer and you can't really be an effective leader, especially of a people who don't really know who they are if you're a downer. So let's get everybody's emotions up first, too.
Look, I think that the idea of starting with a party is always a good idea, right? I mean, that shows in some ways how smart Jethro was as a leader. You come into a new situation and people are a little down. They're a little nervous. They're a little worried. You know, there was the moment at the Red Sea when they look back and they see Pharaoh's army barreling down upon them, the most fearsome army at the time, and they yell at Moses, "What did you do? Why'd you take us out here to die?" Right? And then we have the miracle of the passage of the Red Sea, which also, by the way, involved not just the miracle of God. You know the story of God looking up and Moses looking up to God and God saying, "Ma titzak alai, why do you call out to me? Do something." So this was also the necessity of tachlis, of doing something. But there were these moments in the wandering in the wilderness when there was great frustration, great worry, and to have somebody come in and say, "Look, let's reset the mood here. Let's start everybody saying, look, this is our first steps into freedom, and let's find ourselves in a better mental space." So I think that that was the first brilliant move that Jethro did. And then I also think he came in and he said, "Look, Moses, you're going to wear yourself out, man. You are going to exhaust yourself. You will not last. You have an important mandate." You know, it's kind of the old version of what we now say modernly. This is a marathon, not a sprint, right? And he said, "Let me help you. Let me help you figure out how you can flatten your bureaucratic structure."
I love that point, and I'm thinking about the Exodus story, and but Bezalel, this guy that is introduced in the book of Exodus, and Aholiab, this other guy who is introduced in the book of Exodus, we don't talk about him so much, but they're these two. I don't want to say random schmoes, but we don't know much about them other than that they were chosen in the book of Exodus to lead this sort of construction project. And I think what you just said about flattening and sort of distributing leadership actually plays directly into that, because there's no reason that the Torah couldn't have or God or whoever, however you're theologically looking at this, couldn't have said, like, "Moses, Aaron, figure out this tabernacle thing." But that's not what happened. We figured out that if Moses and Aaron, Moses was already overwhelmed, as Yitro identifies, with all of the squabbles that he was having to solve. So adding that on wouldn't have been helpful. So we do have this flattening happening. And I think that, that to me is part of what the book of Exodus sort of does, is it takes us from this story very, and the remainder of the Torah, like, takes us from this story very centered in Genesis on one family, on one set of a few people, and it broadens it to an entire group. And I think that model is a really helpful one.
I would like to refer to Jethro as a symbol. You know, Jethro, that's also the name of the parasha of the Ten Commandments and Sinai. And it's interesting because Jethro is an outsider. He wasn't part of this group who went out of Egypt. He's actually, you know, he's a religious figure, but outside of this whole group. And his name actually is the name of the parasha. And he really gives such an important advice for how to run this group that is just starting to form itself. And I think, you know, for us to when we talk about Jewish innovation and reinventing, you know, to realize how much we received from outside, from outsiders, from outside communities, that has been, you know, since Sinai, and it has been, this is our story, actually getting gifts from so many cultures and so many people. And actually, for Israeli culture, it's also a very interesting thing, because the Druze community in Israel, they see Jethro as their founding father.
I love that idea of outsiderness, because what I think is sad about some of the later interpretive traditions is that they look at Jethro and they say, "Oh, this party that he threw was actually him converting." So now he's one of us, as if we were not allowed to have this awesome wisdom come from somebody who's outside. And that to me is, first off, I don't think it's there in the text of the Torah. I think they're coming up with an interpretation that doesn't have much basis. But even if there was evidence for that in the text of the story, I think it's a sad way to look at it, because we have this incredible precedent of somebody who's not one of us bringing in an important teaching. And it's not just that that's like an interesting development. It's that actually that's how change often works. It has to be coming from somebody who isn't centralized in the structures. It's no accident that the people who are doing great things like founding Bina are people that are not centered in the broader society and feel like they need a place to have their voice heard.
And by the way, that's the same thing in the Jewish world today. That's the same reason why JCCs and more cutting-edge synagogues are saying, look, institutional life is not like it was even 20, 30 years ago. So how do we bring in outside influences to change that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that with the story of Jethro, you know, just that angle on it that he was an outsider, I think it's really also important just to point out that it's quite clear from the text that the people themselves are not a single people on at least two dimensions, right? One, that they come from these different tribes and they strongly continue to identify with these tribes, these Israelite tribes. But the text also talks about the people as a mixed multitude. And I think there are actually two Hebrew terms that get translated as mixed multitude. One is asafsuf, which sort of has a negative connotation, or at least as I read it, this sort of rabble. And then there's another term, Erev Rav, which really just means a large group of people, a diverse group of people, and Eruv, a mixture, a mixed group of people.
It's interesting, Dan, that you're mentioning the Asafsuf and Erev Rav, because the later commentary actually talks about these groups, and they blame them for everything. They blame them for the golden calf, they blame them. So, yeah, you know, unfortunately, it sounds so familiar. You know, you have these minorities and, you know, the whole political situation around that. So, yeah, we have that in very, very ancient texts. And, you know, in Israel politics in 77, when there was the political flip from the Ma'arach, the left social group, you know, being in power for so many years. And then at 1977, there was this flip that the more right-wing groups took charge. That was one of the slogans. One of the Ma'arach politicians called the, you know, the people from the neighborhoods, they called them Asafsuf. They used this word. So their slogan was Ani Asafsuf Ge'eh. I'm a proud Asafsuf.
Before we move off from Jethro, I want to stay on it just a little bit more, because I think it's really critical to setting up this series that we have coming forward. Because I think there's a lot of other ways that the conversations that we're going to have coming up fit in. But to my mind, they really do include the fact that although the people that we're talking to are Jewish, their expertise is not necessarily Jewish. They're coming from an expertise in the world of technology or entrepreneurship. And so I really want to experience these conversations as conversations with people who are bringing in other kinds of expertise. And it's really important to me, at least in setting this up, to not say, what is talking to somebody at YouTube or at Apple or whatever have to do with Judaism? You know, that actually we really believe that we need to be looking to other sources of ideas and expertise in this process.
So we have this tendency that I think is good of finding all the positive messaging in our stories. I also want to give the text some tochacha, some rebuke, because we situate ourselves in the book of Exodus, and we have this great text of Jethro saying, you know, get all sorts of different people involved in forms of whether we call it leadership or, you know, empower a bunch of people. And then we go, and the next thing that we do, the very next Torah portion, is called Mishpatim, which means laws. We make a whole bunch of rules. And then the next thing that we do after that is we make one centralized building, the tabernacle. Any Jews out there, does this sound familiar? Like we make a bunch of rules and we think that it's all about staying true to particular rules and regulations, and we center everything in building structures. And I mean, we've talked in the past on the podcast about why there's reason to reconsider both of those decisions. But I think it's important to say that, because we, in our ancient times, it's not as if we're looking today at this idealistic, perfect society that figured it out a few thousand years ago and trying to just totally map it into our lives now. It's that they messed up too, and we can learn even from, I don't know, the messings up, the mistakes.
And maybe it was also about, these are people who had just been slaves and they had been beaten down and they had no authority themselves, right? So they were looking to somebody who was Pharaoh-like. They were looking to Moses to kind of make – and Jethro comes and goes, look, the best way to help these folks recover, because they have some serious PTSD about what was going on, is to empower them. Give them the chance to make some decisions. Give them the chance to rule a little bit on some of these smaller problems within their communities. And then you go, okay, but there needs to be some guiding principles. There needs to be some guardrails to keep them within a certain boundary to make sure that they're making the decisions based on something. And that's where you get this idea of, well, here are the laws, and you can take strict interpretation or liberal interpretation, but here are some laws. We're not going to undo the making of the judges from this, but we're going to say, here are the books from which you can rule upon.
I also see that appointing all these people is also democratizing the text and the rules. Because you can't have so many people engaging with the rules without actually influencing the text and the rules and the codex of rules. So I actually see the flow that you have. You have the Ten Commandments, you know, this big, extravagant thing in Sinai. And then after having 10 big rules, you have Mishpatim. Mishpatim is much, much more detailed. And I feel like having all these people judging and actually looking at the details of life, the more complicated, complex details of life, that actually generated Parashat Mishpatim. That actually generated the need for more nuanced and detailed and actually rules that see, you know, the human beings and the life that they're having. So actually, it's interesting. I think we see it in the opposite, you know, the strict rules or actually just nuances of how human beings actually live their lives.
Well, let me throw out another idea, because maybe this is actually a connection to another story that I want to explore, right? And what I'm after here, by the way, ultimately, is if we are setting up the Omer as this newly important Jewish holiday, what are going to be its key stories? And another one that I've been thinking a lot about lately is the story of the scouts, the spies being sent to scout out the land. And technically that happens after the giving of the Torah at Sinai. And I still think that it might connect back to the giving of the Torah in a way that actually, in my view, maybe pushes against the text, meaning I want to suggest that maybe the Torah was given too soon in the story, because the story of the scouts is basically, the basic idea is that God tells Moses to send scouts to go scout out the land and come back and bring a report. They send 12 scouts, they go scout it out, they come back and they say, it's a good land, it's a land flowing with milk and honey, but we saw giants there and we don't think that we could beat these giants, and we saw ourselves in a lowly way, we saw ourselves as grasshoppers in the face of them, and they then also believe that that's how the giants saw them, as grasshoppers, and they basically create this doom and gloom situation that spirals out of control and ultimately results in the people being too afraid to go into the land. And then the punishment that is given at the end of that is, well, this is why you're going to wander around for 40 years in the desert, because you didn't have the faith to believe that you would be able, that God would be with you, that you would be able to take the land. I think the problem with that story was that it was premature to have sent the scouts that early on, right? That, like Zach was talking about, these are newly released slaves. It's not necessarily that they all had to die off, which is the traditional story, but maybe a few weeks after being freed from slavery is too soon to send you off into this basically daring analysis to see. And by the way, I've studied this text with business leaders, and they say, you know, oh yeah, this is how it always happens. You know, you always send the strategic committee to go off and see if we can do this. And they always come back and they say that we can't do it, and it's too difficult and it's too expensive and whatever. And so if that's true of business leaders, then it would seem to be all the more true of recently freed slaves.
And actually the same thing, not exactly the same thing, but very similar thing happened 40 years later when they were just about to cross the Jordan and go into the Promised Land. Then you had two and a half tribes who said, you know what, I think I'm going to stay here. So having this fear of achieving your goal is something that I think a lot of people would identify with, and actually, you know, looking at the Promised Land, you know, and oh my God, it's actually going to happen, which is really, really interesting.
And I actually also like the idea of having started so early in their journey with the Ten Commandments, Dan. I feel like, you know, when a new leader takes over, they have to offer their big vision early on, even if it's going to take a while to achieve the vision. And that's very Silicon Valley, right? Go big or go home. Now, the new model is this design thinking model where you actually maybe offer a big vision, but you start small and you prototype. And you fail forward, fail fast, right? It's about prototyping, pivoting if you make a mistake, learning from your failures, but you still start with this big vision. You know, how am I going to break the internet? How am I going to create a new internet? How am I going to, and then you have to kind of try things out and see where you're going to succeed and where you're going to fail. But I like that the Ten Commandments came early, and that it took a long time for it to get fulfilled with the getting to the land of milk and honey.
So are there any other stories that occur to you as stories that would be especially resonant for this time of year / this time in Jewish history?
I think about the golden calf story too. And when we're in the wilderness, I think about how that was really about a time for questioning identity, right? And I think that there was a fear, like Tova mentioned, about we're finally becoming a nation, a people of laws, and that was a big step forward. And I think about where we are geographically right now in Silicon Valley, where there are so many Israeli expats, and many of them are struggling with their identity. I don't mean to speak on behalf of them, and I'm sitting next to one right now who can speak much better than I, but a lot of Israelis come here, and they don't even think of themselves as quote-unquote Jewish. They say, I'm Israeli, I'm not Jewish, because it means something very different to them, having grown up in Israel. And it's going to have to take some golden calf moments for them to kind of figure it out. And we as community leaders need to be patient and help them through that. You know, I know that Moses' response was not so patient, but I also think that we owe it to them to figure it out by wandering, like the Israelis that finish the army service and they go off and they travel the world for a year, right? And some of them become Buddhists and some of them become Hindus. And they're searching for their own identity after this experience.
I think that having looked at the process, the identity process that Israeli go through here, actually goes back, you know, I look at, you know, the period when we were kicked out of Israel and had to build new Jewish life outside of Israel. And now Israelis need the Jewish Israeli community needing to actually realize what being Jewish out of Israel is. I see a lot of similarities, and I see it a very parallel thing. And if we look at Shavuot, the holiday of Shavuot, I think it's exactly that. Because it used to be an agricultural, agrarian holiday. It used to be, you know, us living on our land on Shavuot, bringing our first fruit to the temple. That was all about celebrating the harvest and all that. And then when we all went to exile, we had to live, you know, away from our land, and we didn't actually live on a land. So we became, from being the nation of the land, we became the nation of the book, from Am Haaretz to Am HaSefer. But we did a pretty good job in just reinventing our culture. So instead of Beit Mikdash, it became Beit Midrash. Instead of sacrifices, it became study. Instead of priests, it became rabbis. And Shavuot actually became from an agrarian holiday to celebrating the book. And I really liked what you suggested, Lex, about the Omer, because I think this is exactly what happened to Shavuot. It became from Omer in Ein to Omer in Aleph. And when you look at the Israeli community here in Silicon Valley, how we actually try to create the new phase of Israeliness within this new place, and also in dialogue with the local Jewish community, as part of the local Jewish community, I see it as an amazing opportunity to actually create the next phase of Judaism. I wouldn't call it Israeliness because it's not Israeliness anymore.
I want to cheat a little and choose a story that's not in the book of Exodus, but is just after, but that I also think we can learn from. It's like you said at the top of the episode, still in the wandering in the wilderness. So, you know, it counts.
Yeah, I think that's legitimate.
And we look, we're unbound, so no bounds of books. But Nadav and Avihu, these two guys come along. They're the sons of Aaron early in the book of Leviticus. And this, again, is a point where I think we can learn what not to do. Because what Nadav and Avihu do, as we look at this lens of like deep experimentation and sort of questioning everything that the Omer has been and that Judaism has been in the past and rethinking. What they do is, we don't know exactly, but they do something that is called a foreign offering by the text. We don't know what that means, but we know that they do something that is different than the offerings to God that have been prescribed. They appear to be sort of young hotshots that, to steal from Greek mythology, like flew too close to the sun, like Icarus. And what happens is they're smitten by God on the spot. And I hate to say it, but I think that when a lot of these conversations start to happen about really opening up to crazy, new, wild, foreign ideas, we in our Jewish institutional communities occasionally smite folks on the spot. Not literally, God willing, but we do tend to find all the reasons that those ideas won't work without entertaining how they could. And I think that that's a really important element for us to hold and learn from as we try to make the Omer into this really wildly exciting experimental time.
I love that analogy. You know, in your terminology of Judaism 4.0, right? Are we in this moment where we need to evolve Judaism? There is this worry that, well, if 1.0 is the Mishkan period and 2.0 is the temple period and 3.0 is synagogue period, which we're in now, are you even able to talk about 4.0 without being smitten by the leaders of the synagogue movement, right? Is that why we have to talk about 3.93? It's a patch. It's not a new OS. I love the way you guys have talked about this. And then we can go back into deeper, you know, is it an app, a folder of apps? But the danger of talking about 4.0 openly and not doing it like a Skunkworks model, as Dan has suggested, is that the fear of being smitten by those who are in power in the Jewish community and saying, look, that era is of the past. That's a scary thing. And I think that it's what's kept us from being able to be really, really creative and push the envelope very far.
Yeah, and to make the connection to the world of tech and Silicon Valley, I think that same question is in the world of disruptive innovation in general, right? Which is that if you're an innovator who's creating something that truly has the potential to disrupt the main industry, then it's very likely that the industry will have one of two reactions, right? One is that they'll try to crush you. That's obviously bad. And the other is that they'll acquire you. And that's also bad for your innovation, right? It's not necessarily bad for your salary, but but it turns that potentially disruptive innovation into a sustaining feature, which makes the product better, but makes it less likely to actually solve the problem that disruption is ultimately trying to solve. So I think that I would put the challenge out there for our listeners and for everybody who is interested in this idea of exploring the possibility of seeing the Omer in a new way, for exploring an imagination and the most openness that we have during the entire year, right? The most comfort that we have in not knowing what we are or what we're going to become. Number one, what are other texts? What are other sources? What are other rituals that we might play around with as a way to fully embrace and embody this idea? But I'm wondering if there are any other key thoughts that any of you all would like to share in terms of thinking about what are elements from the tech world, from the world of Silicon Valley, that may be most likely to be important as we try to connect them to the evolving story of Judaism in the 21st century.
I think looking at the fact that the Omer is kind of forgotten mostly because there isn't a ritual. There is a ritual of actually counting. You need to count every night, 1, 2, 3, until 49. That's not a very robust ritual. So there is a gap there. And I see, you know, in so many holidays that the ritual is not very popular, that there is a lot of room for innovation. But traditionally, two things actually did get in. And I see them as like opposing, and it's actually fascinating. You see the Omer associated with mourning, and it's really bizarre. You would think we're waiting for the Torah, we're counting until Sinai. Why is it a time for mourning? And I'm thinking maybe, you know, it's time for cautiousness. Don't get too excited. Don't have too many wild ideas. You need to restrain yourself a little bit. And on the other hand, you have Lag BaOmer, the 33rd day of the Omer, which is a day of joy. It's a day of celebration. There are so many different parts of this day. It's a bit complicated. But you have these two opposing elements of mourning and joy within this period that I think it has a lot to do with shaping our culture and reshaping our culture, that the tension there says a lot about how complex it is and how exciting it is.
We're trying to grab on locally to this idea of how Lag BaOmer can become relevant in people's lives. So we recreated last year a new ritual called Burning Mensch, the idea being like Burning Man. But we do it here on Lag BaOmer. It's about fire. It's about coming together as a community. It's about being together and celebrating together. And it's another way of saying, how can we take this ritual that's not very well known outside of Israel or outside of Orthodox circles and make it relevant and fun for people today and add the learning component as well? And I think that we have that opportunity with the Omer too. I mean, just being in the home of the 49ers, just for starters. Hmm. I mean, there's that number right there.
That's a great, great thought. I grew up, for whatever reason, my dad latched onto the 49ers. He never lived in the Bay Area, but I grew up rooting very hard for the 49ers and having a Jerry Rice-themed AIM screen name, actually. But I love the 40. I had never thought about the 49ers in association with the Omer, so I love that.
Tova, I want to go back to what you were saying about the time of mourning, because it strikes me that it's maybe particularly apropos to our time and to Silicon Valley, because as I recall, the reason why the Omer is seen as this time of mourning is because there was a plague of some kind that killed many of the students of Rabbi Akiva during another time of wandering, that time between the destruction of the Second Temple and sort of the dawn of Rabbinic Judaism. And Rabbi Akiva in the tradition was one of the most radical thinkers of the early rabbinic period, and his students would have been among the most radical thinkers. And it sort of strikes me that that has a connection to the reality that we've talked about in terms of Silicon Valley as being a place where, right, most of the ideas fail, right? Where if you're going to be super innovative, then you have to expect that there's going to be a lot of failure, which metaphorically we can see as death. And that somehow, when assuming that we see a successful transition to Judaism 4.0, that we're going to look back and be happy about the fact that we've made it. But I think we're also going to look back both with some regret at what we may have had to leave behind, as well as the failed experiments along the way. And nevertheless, that's not a reason not to do those experiments. And so I'm really excited to jump into this series, looking at Silicon Valley as a new metaphor for this time of wandering, and maybe more than a metaphor.
Yeah, I think that's a really great note to end on, Dan. And we just want to thank Zach Bodner and Tova Birnbaum for coming on today. We're also excited that Zach will be back in a number of weeks to close out this series of Omer episodes connected to Silicon Valley. And we're excited to see what that's going to look like, to debrief all the episodes that are coming up and to think about what we do with all of this newfound information moving forward. So thanks again to Zach and Tova for coming on today. And we're looking forward to having you back, Zach, in the future.
Thanks for having us. We really enjoyed being a part of it.
Thank you so much, and happy Omer.
Happy Omer. Absolutely. So as we close out this episode, we want to encourage our listeners to be in touch with us as always. And there's a few ways for you to do that. One is that you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Another is that you can head to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@nextjewishfuture.org and lex@nextjewishfuture.org. The last plug we like to make is that if you're able to support us financially, you can always do so at judaismunbound.com/donate with either a one-time gift or a recurring monthly donation. So thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.